I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Dutch authorities announced today they'll soon begin using full-body scanners on all passengers flying from Amsterdam to the U.S., something the U.S. and the EU hadn't approved up till now because of privacy concerns. Meanwhile, President Obama said last night that if bits of information about the Christmas Day airline bomb suspect had been pieced together, he'd never have been allowed on a plane. Obama's ordered a full review due tomorrow. And today in Yemen, where the suspect claims to have obtained his bomb-making materials from the group Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Yemeni forces raided an Al-Qaeda hideout. The Yemeni government has been working with the U.S. to fight Al-Qaeda, but is also dealing with a separatist movement. Let's check in with the Wall Street Journal's Evan Perez. Evan, first, the Amsterdam airport, they have 15 of these full-body scanners, among the most in the world. But even if a scanner would have been able to detect the suspect's material, would it matter? There are reports that he was in transit and wouldn't need to go through security again.
We're told by the Dutch airport authorities that there is a rescanning process that happens between flights from outside of the EU. And in this case, it's a flight that was coming to the U.S., so there would have been a rescan, and there was. The problem here is that, you know, by the time he gets to Amsterdam, this has been already a huge security failure on the part of the U.S. I mean, this is by the time you have this guy presenting himself at the airport with his U.S. visa, valid U.S. visa, with all of this stuff, it's already a failure because really the president said yesterday this should have been detected much earlier.
And then we're also hearing now about communication intercepts suggesting that a Nigerian was being prepared for a terrorist strike by Al-Qaeda operatives in Yemen.
Right, and all of these small bits and pieces, I mean, the president yesterday suggested that this was a major breach, and he viewed this as if you had only connected the dots, you might have been able to stop this person from getting on this plane. We've talked to people in government, people in the different agencies involved, and they say it's not even clear now that if you had all these bits of information, you might have been able to piece it together. In hindsight, of course, everything looks different, but the bits and pieces were really just that. There was chatter, there was small intercepts, and then put together, obviously, with the father meeting with the CIA in Nigeria. Now, of course, we know a lot more.
Well, Evan, just if you could just elaborate, from what you're hearing from intelligence people, what do we take from that? Does that mean that a lot of people are alerting officials to someone that they think might be a potential bomber? Does that mean that there's a lot of chatter about training people from different countries to attack the U.S.? I'm imagining it does.
Right. I mean, that is the huge, huge challenge that, you know, the security services in the U.S. and in other Western countries are facing. There is just a tremendous volume of information. The Internet is recruiting ground for extremists. As you know, the NSA and other agencies have facilities overseas that are basically trying to capture metadata of internet communications, telephone calls, and so on. And a lot of that stuff just cannot be looked at real time. It's just really difficult. I mean, we have an embarrassment of riches in terms of intelligence. What is more difficult to do is to try to figure out what to do with that.
Right. Meanwhile, we're hearing today about a case in Somalia. A Somali man who did try to board a plane in Mogadishu carrying somewhat similar bomb materials, and security people in Mogadishu caught him.
Right, that doesn't speak well of our security system. Somalia is not exactly a functioning country right now. What happened in that case is you know, the security people were able to detect something and were perhaps reacting to behavior, and perhaps because, you know, obviously that country is in the middle of a war, people doing screening are perhaps more on edge and more careful.
Mm-hmm. Well, just on a touch on Yemen's role, the suspect studied there, claimed to get his bomb materials there. We've reported on how Guantanamo detainees were released during the Bush administration to Saudi Arabia to be rehabbed. They slipped into Yemen. They're now part of this new Al-Qaeda group there. How has the recent spotlight on Yemen impacted the Guantanamo Bay release program?
Well, as I was told by one administration official yesterday, you're not going to see any new releases to Yemen anytime soon. Just about less than a week, on December 20th, just sort of less than a week before the attempted bombing in the Northwest flight, the U.S. released 6 detainees to Yemen. And if you read the documentation that the U.S. government provided, they basically were saying that the only reason they were releasing these people is because they were expecting to lose habeas corpus petitions that are filed in the U.S. courts. So essentially, they felt that the courts were about to force their hand, so they might as well go ahead and do it. There are about 45 detainees from Yemen that could be released if only they were a different nationality. And what you might end up seeing is that many of those people could end up sitting in a cell in Thompson, Illinois, when that new facility takes over the role that Guantanamo now serves.
Evan Perez of The Wall Street Journal. Evan, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Take a turn here. Chances are many American parents have a new or dog-eared copy of British psychologist Penelope Leach's groundbreaking book, Your Baby and Child. Leach has influenced generations with her child-centered philosophy since originally publishing her landmark book in 1978. We spoke to her after her latest book, Child Care Today, Getting It Right for Everyone, first came out last January. We started by asking her why people get so heated about this topic.
It is, I think, the major conundrum of the century. I know that sounds extreme, but I think the whole business of how parents can be in two places at once, which most of us have never learnt to be, and be really hitting a family-friendly balance between working and caring. How much time do I spend earning money to spend on my child, and how much time do I spend being with my child? I think this is something that's, we call it the elephant in the corner. Do you have that expression?
Sure, elephant in the living room.
Elephant in the living room. We fiddle with it. We talk about it a lot. Media talk about it a lot. We don't actually face the fact that we need to resolve it in some more basic way.
Well, then I don't think parents struggling with these questions that you just started to list would think at all you're overdoing it to say that it's such a big issue. It's a huge issue. And I want to get something right on the table. You wrote the 1994 book, Children First.
Yep.
Now, many people thought the takeaway from that book was that young children that spend extended periods of time in daycare are at risk emotionally or psychologically. And
yep.
A lot of working moms at that time thought that that book was an attack. What is your overarching thought about daycare in this new book?
Okay. That book was written in the mid-90s. Talking about now, in this new millennium, we have a situation where children's needs haven't changed. All babies and young children need to be cared for by a caring grown-up every hour of every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for at least 10 years. That's a huge commitment. The question is, who's going to do it? And what's changed is that where that used to be kind of almost taken for granted mom, now it isn't. And it isn't just because mothers, women, want to be in the workplace. It is because modern economies can't possibly exist without all healthy adults working and earning.
So Penelope Leach, I just want to make sure, it sounds like you've changed your mind. It sounds like you were saying in Children First that a caring mom had to be present for those years, and it sounds like you're now saying maybe she can't be, but also you are now pointing to research that shows that it's not as much who it is that loves the child, but that the child be loved.
Yes, 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 a million times yes. All the research shows that that relationship, they call it attachment if we're being posh about it, is more important to that child's well-being for years to come than anything about the childcare. And it isn't so much that I've changed my mind as that society has changed. If you've got a community, not society, but a community, a street, where the ordinary thing is for parents or a parent to be home with a kid until he's 3-4 years old and begins to go to school, then that's going to be the way that feels right, feels normal. But if you've got a street like we have today where that's a very unusual thing to do, then it's quite different for the parent. And being a full-time mom at home now is something which a lot of people find very difficult. And if they find it difficult, they don't often do it terribly well. What women want is absolutely crucial to the well-being of children.
Well, and in fact, you point to researchers who say that a mother who is not happy but is at home is as likely to have lasting ill effects on a young child as a mother being separated from a child.
Yes, yes. So if you're in a not very good childcare nursery, but you've got a wonderful relationship going on at home, you're better off than if the relationship at home's a bit dicey and you're in a brilliant childcare.
Oh, that's fascinating. Tell us more, though. Okay, so it's if you have a good relationship at home but not such a good daycare, that's still okay?
Well, it's better than the other way round. Of course, it's not ideal. But what that message, what I've just said, really means is that having enough time to forge those bonds, to get to know that baby, to get, dare I use that term, attached to it, which is a mutual thing, so that you've got that baby somewhere in your mind all the time, even when you're at work, you've got some bit of your mind that's always with that child. To get that established, people need time. And to some of us, and I don't want to be rude, I'm on American radio here and conscious of it and grateful, but some of us are very horrified to hear about the ages at which some American babies have to go into full daycare, because we do find it amazing that that should be taking place maybe even before 3 months.
Well, let's explain why. The U.S. government offers mothers no paid maternity leave. They might get it from work,
exactly, but
they don't get any help from the government.
Mm-hmm.
And it only requires that companies offer 3 months of unpaid leave. So you're saying at 3 months, many of these children are going off. But what happens in other countries?
I have to start by saying that the United States is the only post-industrial Western country that gives no federally mandated maternity or familial leave at all. The only one. It is shocking. The whole of Europe, Canada, New Zealand do.
And how much do they give?
The sort of average is round about 9 months.
9 months?
Yeah. And
is it paid leave?
Yeah. And that's terribly important. In fact, if maternity leave is unpaid, most people won't take it. But even if the money's not very much, and here, I mean, it's like $120 a week here in the UK that mothers get, and that's not enough to live on. But even if that money is not very much, everybody will take all they're entitled to. And the reason, I think, is something to do with feeling respected, feeling honoured, feeling that it's socially okay to take 6 months or even 9 months off from your professional job to rear this baby.
It has dignity attached to it.
It has dignity, exactly, yeah. Thank you. That's exactly the word I was looking for. The UK, although it's improved hugely since 1997, isn't nearly as good on this as some of the European countries, particularly, of course, Scandinavia. One of the reasons the Scandinavian countries can provide such excellent childcare is that they hardly provide any for babies. Babies are almost all at home with their mothers or their fathers because there's paternity and maternity leave for at least a year. So that's very expensive to provide daycare for babies in the first year. So the fact that they hardly have to do that means that that money, that taxpayers' money, goes into excellent care later in the second and third years.
Penelope Leach, her most recent book is Child Care Today, Getting It Right for Everyone, and she mentioned time off for new moms in Scandinavian countries. Here's some specifics. In Sweden, new mothers get 13 months off and 80% of their full-time salary. It's similar in Norway, but parents there can take even more time off at a lower rate of pay. We're going to have more with Penelope Leach after a quick break. Later, I'll tell you later. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with renowned childcare expert Penelope Leach. We first spoke with her in last January, when her latest book, Child Care Today, Getting It Right for Everyone, first came out. And in it, she says that it's not as important that mom stay home as that mom finds someone who loves her child. So how do you find that person to take care of your child? Here's more of our conversation with Penelope Leach. Penelope, when our colleague Kevin Sullivan and his wife Lucia tried to find daycare for their infant, they found an Italian grandmother running a center in her home, but Lucia didn't know what to ask her.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked this woman, trying to sound very official, "What is your child care philosophy?"
Yeah.
And the woman seemed confused. She said, "It's a baby. We love the baby. We kiss the baby." It seems like you, Penelope Leach, are saying, that's your answer.
Well, the first year, I'd be very happy with a loving Italian grandmother myself, provided I liked her and she liked me.
Because, again, just to reinforce, what you're looking for is love, is someone who will be that thing that an infant needs. And the key people, they're called, these
yes.
key people outside the mother.
Key people, yeah. And the trick to being the key person, the good key person, is above all sensitive and responsive, which sounds a little more official than love. I mean, it comes to the same thing, let's face it. But sensitive in the sense of aware of what the baby's feeling like and thinking about and trying to do and so on. And responsive in the sense, if you watch somebody with a baby like 5 months old and she smiles at the baby and the baby very, very, very slowly begins to smile back. And if you're watching, you can see this going on. The unresponsive person will have turned away and got on with something else before that baby's got round to smiling.
So there's that first element. But tell us, what else should someone look for in a childcare provider outside the home?
Well, if you're looking for a child who's a little older, you're looking above all for not only a high ratio, like at least one adult to, say, three toddlers, but you need to go look what's going on. Often we were told this was the ratio in this room of three adults to 12 children, say. But when we got in there, one was taking a coffee break, one had got a bit late coming in, and one of the so-called staff was actually an as yet untrained apprentice. So you need, if you're looking for childcare, you do need to go and look.
You also say there should be a view of the outside. There should be the ability to go outside and play.
Yeah. I worry about childcare centres or nurseries being a very limited environment for children. And sometimes a few parents, I think, are perhaps a bit taken in by the beautiful toys and equipment, developmental toys, tiny toilets, low-down wash basins, everything beautiful. But if you think of spending all day, every weekday, in that one room, in that one environment, if you were at home with that Italian grandmother you mentioned, you'd probably be going in your buggy, out to the store, you'd probably be going to the park. I worry about it being almost more limited than being in an open plan office all day.
The way their parents are.
The way their parents are.
In your book, you talk about something that might be the panacea of childcare. It's an integrated childcare center offering care for several years and catering to children and parents. These are found in Scandinavian countries. Can you describe them? And then, you know, why haven't they, you know, taken hold here?
The idea is that you make a sort of one-stop shop for young families in a neighbourhood. You want daycare, but you also want playrooms and drop-in centres for children who are perhaps with grandparents or with other kinds of home daycare providers, or who are at home with grandchildren, or mothers who are at home and bored silly themselves. Because somewhere you can go with your small child, you know, if you do it well enough, that centre becomes not only the obvious place for daycare and play centres and playrooms and what have you, but also the obvious place to try a little children's theatre, or somebody wants to try out some new art lessons with children or music or whatever. We've got all this stuff going on in the community, but if they were in the centres, they'd become open to a great many more people.
What would you say to those who say, this is ridiculous, my taxpayer money shouldn't go to take care of other people's kids?
If you've got enough taxpayer money that you don't need any help providing for your own kids, which probably means either that both two parents have got to go 75% time each, or one parent's got to go half time, or even one parent's got to stay home full time. If you can afford that in the modern world, and that's what you'd like to do, then I couldn't be more for it. But for a great many parents, that isn't an option. It can't be done. And a huge burden is being placed on grandparents, many of whom nowadays need to work later themselves and are giving up jobs or going part-time in order to provide help with grandchildren. And I know it sounds lovely being looked after by your grandmother, but when you talk to a lot of those grandmothers, quite a lot of them say things like, and I quote this in the book, I love those children, heavens I do, but I don't love doing this. I thought I was finished with this. I thought I'd done my child rearing.
Yeah. And I'm quoting Sebastian Kramer, psychiatrist, in your book, saying no one can care for a child alone.
Mm-hmm. This is the modern version of it takes a village to rear a child. I don't think it takes a village, but I think you can't actually balance even two parents and two children and a full-time job and make it work. You need more backup than that. It doesn't work.
Childcare specialist Penelope Leach. Her book is Childcare Today, Getting It Right for Everyone. By the way, what do you think? We'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us. You can send an email or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. Remember, too, you can follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. Tomorrow on Here and Now, did you emerge from the past decade a winner or a loser? The answer might depend on how you feel about Twitter or Ustream, where you can webcast your entire life online. Also tomorrow, we look back at the films of the decade. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, end of the road for editor and publisher, which is shutting down after a century of covering the newspaper business. Ironies abound. We're back after the latest news, Here and Now. Residents of the western Massachusetts city of Northampton are sleeping by their front doors and planning a neighborhood watch after a series of suspected arson fires over the weekend killed a father and son and left two families homeless. Investigators say they have no suspects. Northampton has been plagued by suspicious fires for 4 years now. At least one woman is planning to move after her home was torched on Sunday, but Robert Davis, who woke up to see his car ablaze, wants to stay.
We've got a good neighborhood, and it's like a family. And my thing is, I've got two kids raised in this area, got a magnificent wife. I like it around here.
Davis was one of a couple hundred Northampton residents who attended a meeting last night with city officials. Jerry Budgar was there as well. He's president of the Neighborhood Association for Ward 3, which was hit by the fires. Jerry, what's going on today? How are people dealing with this?
The ward is traumatized. This is foreign to Northampton. It's a beautiful community. You know, people feel safe and secure here, and that's been stolen from them because of the events that happened Saturday night.
And we understand even from your home you can see the home where a father and his son were killed by a fire.
Yes, I can look out my kitchen window and see it, and then today they're beginning to demolish it, and I can see that as we speak.
Well, we heard about another woman, Naomi Cairns, who was the only one home when her home was set on fire on Sunday. And again, officials are pretty much sure these are arson fires. 3 years ago, she almost died when another house she lived in was torched. Do authorities have any clue?
You know, I understand both sides of the issue here. I'm a former investigative reporter, and I know how difficult arson is as a charge to bring and a charge to prove. On the other hand, I know that the residents feel shut out. They aren't getting the information that they feel they need to feel comforted that things are being done. But I know that there is a tremendous deployment of resources into the city over the past couple days to get into this investigation.
Well, at last night's meeting, you heard a resident there, Jonathan Brody, told Mayor Claire Higgins that it wasn't until two people died that city officials got proactive about all these fires. Mayor Higgins responded that police and firefighters have been out. This is, as you said, one of the most difficult crimes to prove. But do people in the ward feel, as Jonathan said, that they're somehow on the wrong side of the tracks?
I know the police and fire officials. They live in this community. They're taking this very personally, that this is an intrusion on their community, and they want this resolved as quickly as anyone else does.
Right. And we should say the neighborhood within walking distance of downtown was once quite an immigrant neighborhood. And now we see it's populated by former professors. Western Massachusetts, where Northampton is silly with colleges. So it's got a variety of people who live there. Are they coming together in ways maybe they might not?
Oh, absolutely. I have received between 100 and 125 phone calls a day and 20 to 25 emails an hour. Jerry, what can we do? What can we provide? Mm-hmm. I've had a call this morning from the Hampshire Sheriff's Office. They have provided 300 free fire detectors for people who need them. I mean, it has just been unbelievably overwhelming, the kind of coming together and support that we're seeing because of what's happened here.
Meantime, we understand some of your neighbors are packing up their precious items and photographs, giving them to friends to keep who are out of the area. You're hoping to start a neighborhood watch group. But we're reading today that neighboring Worcester, Massachusetts, also has had a string of fires. We remember a year ago, a church in Western Mass was torched. What do you think is next?
I'm the last one you should ask. These things just mystify me. How people can get satisfaction out of wreaking such havoc on a community is far beyond me to understand.
Do people worry that the arsonist might be among them?
Yes.
Yeah. And that can't be good for a neighborhood.
Well, you know, many of the experts have told us that arsonists, in many instances, live very close to the area where the fires are set. So, yes, there's some concern that this person is among us.
That's Jerry Budgar, president of the Ward 3 Neighborhood Association in Northampton, Massachusetts, which has seen a string of arson fires, one of which killed a father and his son. Jerry, thanks for speaking with us.
You're very welcome, and I hope we never have to have this conversation again, at least about this subject.
Yeah. We also want to thank WFCR Public Radio out there in Amherst for helping out with this report. Jerry, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, up next, the soon-to-be former editor-in-chief of Editor and Publisher magazine, in 30 seconds, here and now. Nearly 150 American newspapers have shut down this past year as the industry struggles for revenue and readership, and that's a big story. But the publication that would have been all over it is also shutting down. Editor and Publisher magazine, which has covered the newspaper business for 125 years, is being closed by its new parent company, Nielsen, which cites falling ad revenues and circulation. 18 people will be out of a job, including Greg Mitchell. He's been the editor-in-chief of Editor and Publisher since 2002. Joins us from his office in New York, where I guess you guys are still hanging on, Greg, that there might be some hope?
Yes, we did ship our final issue this week and kept our website going. And there was such a tremendous outpouring of sort of outrage and support with the news of our inexplicable closing that you know, a number of people stepped forward and are interested in possibly keeping us going, but it's you know, that's a tough battle. So we'll see what happens.
It really is, and especially since you cover an industry that's ailing, it's sort of caught in sort of a cyclical thing.
Yeah, but nevertheless, we have been in no worse shape than most other magazines. We're making money as late as last year, and projected to make money next year.
Well, you're being closed, but Nielsen announced a sale of several of its other trade publications, mm-hmm. Hollywood Reporter, Billboard, Adweek. Why weren't you sold as opposed to being closed?
Well, we don't really know. It seems very odd to us, given the great support and the fact that we were not really on the brink financially, at least as far as we can tell. So I think it's a matter of perception of an allegedly dying industry that we cover, which is not even true. So I think it's very short-sighted based on, you know, we have the bad luck of covering the industry that's gotten probably more ink for its hard times than practically any,
right.
And that may be because so many people in the media are like to write about the media. So I think it's sort of bad luck that newspapers have gotten such a bad rap, which is only partway deserved.
This is interesting because we're thinking about media analyst Dan Kennedy, who actually has been saying that things aren't as bad as they first seemed at the beginning of this year at newspapers. He says that corporate debt makes papers look in worse health than they really are. In other words, it has to do with their parent companies, not them.
Right.
That newspapers still have some fat on them because they swelled up so big as they had such glory years in the 80s, and that if they cut back, they'd still be fine. And finally, he says, you know, papers are finally starting to think about charging for online material so they're not giving so much away. So Dan Kennedy has some sense that, you know, the industry may turn itself around. Do you feel that way?
Well, our closing editorial, we say that it'll be a shame if Editor and Publisher isn't around to sort of chart the better days to come. Of course, everyone agrees, and we were out front in this a long, long time ago, saying that certainly print is in decline, that certainly focus should be online, that we have pushed the transition to online going back about 15 years. So we've recognized all that, but the question is, what happens with newspapers overall? Most newspapers have very, very vibrant websites. Of course, the dirty little secret is that most newspapers are still making a profit. Some of them are still making a very good profit. Newspapers that people think are in great trouble, with the McClatchy chain or the Gannett chain, they're all making money. They've gotten that perhaps by cutting to the bone. They haven't gotten it by expanding revenue or circulation. But nevertheless, they've sort of downsized to the point where they're still profitable. And, you know, a profitable business, not such a bad thing.
Right.
So I don't expect newspapers to go away anytime soon, and it's a shame if EMP is not around to continue to push them in the right direction and call them on their many mishaps and be both supportive and critical, as is fitting.
Well, and some of us would agree with you that it would be a shame if EMP weren't around. And yet, I'm wondering if there are people, maybe even Nielsen, saying, why do we need an industry trade magazine? Maybe 100 years ago, but now we've got blogs, we've got everybody and their brother, we've got whole television shows devoted to analyzing the media. It's a become a, you know, belly button, navel-gazing kind of a sport. So why do we need editor and publisher?
Well, I think most of the things you just mentioned are strictly opinion outlets. An editor and publisher has always done hard reporting. We've certainly done more and more commentary and analysis, spotting trends, pushing people in certain directions and so forth. But both on our very popular website and in print, there's a tremendous amount of real journalism. Most of the media work that goes on now is pure opinion, punditry, puffery. The value of EMP has always been, first of all, we do hard journalism, and second, we're not in anybody's pocket, you know. So we call them as we see them, and I think we're one of the few sort of major trade magazines that was really not afraid to bite the hand that feeds us and speak frankly about some of the problems in the industry.
Give me an example of that.
Well, all sorts of things related to, I suppose most famously, won all sorts of major awards for our coverage of the run-up to the Iraq War and the coverage of the Iraq War, where with hard journalism showed that newspapers kind of blew it before that became an accepted view.
Is this referred to stories like Judith Miller at the New York Times,
yeah,
who was embedded with military people and maybe bought their line too much?
Yeah. Yeah, we had 5 years of coverage even before the Iraq War, or well before the invasion, saying that the press was sort of blowing the coverage. So that's sort of one edge of it, the newsroom angle, but also the business angle and the web angle. And, we were pressing in the mid-90s for newspapers to go online, and sort of a lot of them were dragged kicking and screaming onto the web. And we kept saying, you've got to do it, you've got to go faster. So about 10 years later, a lot of them sort of recognized that they blew that too.
What's been the reaction from some of your readers?
Oh, it's been incredible. I mean, we were gratified and a little amazed that this magazine, which, you know, we know that people in the media industry is very familiar with. A lot of them told us they got their first jobs through editor and publisher. And
we should mention that the classified section is a big way for newspaper people to get jobs.
Right. So it's sort of legendary. It's one of the oldest magazines in the country, 125 years. But yet, you know, not that many people have actually seen it or read it, even though our website is very popular. So we were kind of surprised at the outpouring. We got, you know, thousands of messages of support. We even became the number four leading trending topic on Twitter for that entire day, which is really a mass audience and a younger audience. So it was really something. It's great to hear this from people. And, it's given us a chance at least to hope that someone will step forward and we'll go on. But, we are down to our possible final week here.
Well, hopefully something will happen for you. We wait to see. That's Greg Mitchell, editor-in-chief for at least a little while longer of Editor and Publisher Magazine, which after 125 years in business published its final edition this week as its new owner, Nielsen, has looked to close it. Greg, thanks so much for talking to us.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
If you think of 2009 as a baseball game, then it's the bottom of the ninth, two outs, nobody on as the year draws to a close. It's been a year of falling tigers, a concurrence on concussions in the NFL, a gaggle of grand slams for Roger Federer, for Jimmy Johnson, four straight NASCAR Sprint Cups, more gold for the fleet-footed Usain Bolt, and for the evil empire, a championship trophy for the mantle of their new home in the Bronx. That's Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports show Only a Game, to give us a wrap-up of the books published in 2009. And you start with baseball, and what about Satchel Paige? Why?
Well, Satchel Paige was an absolutely unparalleled character in terms of not only his talents, but the incredible stories that he inspired and in some cases created out of whole cloth. Larry Tye has written a wonderful biography of Satchel Paige.
And you say Larry Tye makes an excellent case for Satchel Paige as pioneer and progressive, But no Jackie Robinson.
Well, they didn't give him a chance to be Jackie Robinson. Major League Baseball kept Satchel Paige out of the major leagues throughout what should have been the prime of his career, and so his prime was spent elsewhere in the Negro Leagues and on barnstorming teams. He did eventually get a shot in 1948 for a couple of years in the major leagues, and he wowed him, although nobody was quite sure how old Satchel was, and by that time, Satchel probably wasn't sure how old he was either. Right.
Well, the book is called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend by Larry Tye, the first on Bill Littlefield's list. The second is a book about golf. Now, we're thinking 2010, the books we're going to see about Tiger Woods. But your book from 2009 is one about Michelle Wee.
Yeah, I was really delighted with this book. Eric Anderson has been interviewing Michelle Wee since she was about 10 years old, a phenom. The story about the beginning of her golf career, of course, was a very young woman dominated by her father and his idea of what her career ought to look like. And there were an awful lot of ruts in the road. And since the book came out, of course, Michelle Wee has finally won a golf tournament on the LPGA. So she's at least gotten past that barrier. But it's very well done. It's a bit of a story of sort of the perils of what can befall an extremely talented young athlete who is perhaps not quite as well advised as she might be and probably should get out from under her parents as quickly as possible.
Right. You know, many on both the men's and women's tour a little miffed at her.
Much, much less in the present. Her competition on the American squad in international competition has been marvelously good for her image. She's grown up a good deal, apparently. And seems to be much more comfortable in her own skin than she used to be.
Okay, the book about her, Eric Anderson's The Sure Thing. We'll have this all at our website, hereandnow.org. But now we want to move on to sports at the movies.
I have a personal announcement, though. I'm placing a personal bounty on the head of Tim McCracken. He's the coach and chief punk on that Syracuse team.
A bounty?
Yeah. $100 of my own money for the first of my men that really nails that creep.
That's a late Paul Newman. As Reggie Dunlop, the player coach of the Charlestown Chiefs hockey team, in a scene from Slapshot, the number 6 film in the book, The Ultimate Book of Sports Movies by Ray Dittinger and Glenn Macnow. How did they come up with their rankings?
Well, their rankings are completely insane because Slapshot isn't first. anybody with any sense knows Slapshot's the greatest sports movie ever made.
Wait a minute, how about Caddyshack?
Caddyshack is somewhere down the list. Slapshot is the best. They make a lot of mistakes in this book. They don't rank Bend It Like Beckham nearly as high as it should be.
Spoken
either.
As a true soccer fan.
But these guys are Philadelphia guys, and so they like Rocky, and they like all the sports movies set in Philadelphia. But it's a fun book because it does exactly what a book like this should do, which is inspire arguments and discussions, and everybody has a favorite in this category, and, you know, it's great fun.
Here's another one of the films that made it to the top five in the Ultimate Book of Sports Movies, Robert De Niro as Jake LaMotta in Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull.
Why are you pulling out of Wednesday's fight, Jake? It's over for me. Boxing's over for me. I'm true. I'm tired of worrying about weight all the time. That's all I used to think about was weight, weight, weight. After a while, you know, you realize other things in life. I mean, I'm very grateful. Boxing has been good to me. I got a nice house. I got 3 great kids. I got a wonderful, beautiful wife. What more can I ask for? Huh?
I love that. What more can I ask for?
It's great. Not only is he true, but he's true.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really true. He's finished.
Right. But the hard thing I would think about picking great sports films is that, especially with Rocky in mind, there's such a blueprint now.
There is, and I think one of the nice things about this book is it reminds you of how often the blueprint has been ignored. You mentioned Million Dollar Baby. That would be a pretty good example,
right.
I think. There have also been a lot of really bad movies set in sports, and some of them are included in the book, and it's fun to go back and laugh at how bad they really were.
Well, another of your best of books for 2009, Losing Season by Jack Riddle, a collection of poems written from the perspective of people connected with a really bad high school basketball team. Give us a sense.
Well, Jack Riddle is a very good poet. That's the first point to make. His father was a basketball coach, and as a young kid, Jack saw the impact of losing on his father, on his family, and he tagged along and he met everybody from the water boy to the star player. The second thing is that he has a terrific eye for detail. So that not only is he writing about the star, but he's writing about the scrub. He's writing about the cheerleader. He's writing about mom waiting at home, wondering what kind of mood the coach is going to be in when he comes home from another loss.
Again, Jack Riddle's Losing Season. You have a poem there? One that
Yeah, I'm going to pick one. It's called Coach Dreams of Being on Vacation. Swathed in number 4 copper tone, Coach sits in his beach chair watching the Atlantic roll itself toward his toes, his belly white as a gull's, the sun playing him tight. He listens to the waves, the children squealing, the stockbrokers still talking big bucks as their wives try to coax them offshore, and the teenagers laughing as they roll under the cool water or whispering as they bake next to each other, fingers laced. Suddenly he wants to buy some jeans, open his shirt, take his wife across state lines, but his brain's a gym. Every move he makes draws jeers, even here, dreaming himself a surfer, builder of sandcastles, a stud who strolls the shoreline or just leaning back into the sand to feel the salt air sift across his body. He can hear the catcalls. You're a bum, coach. You're a lousy bum.
Oh, you know what goes on inside the mind of a losing coach in the summer.
Even on the beach. Isn't it awful?
Great. Again, Jack Riddle's Losing Season. Finally, tell us about Outcasts United, a refugee team, an American town.
This is a wonderful story about a coach, a woman named Luma, who connects with a bunch of refugee kids in Georgia and molds them into a soccer team. And these are kids who have nothing, and they feel rotten, and they can't speak the language, and they can't even speak each other's languages because they're refugees from so many different countries. And she manages to help them grow and learn and feel confident about each other and successful on the soccer pitch as well as off it. And it's just a great story about a woman who devotes her time and her energy and her expertise to helping a lot of children that nobody else was helping.
And it's a story that might be happening elsewhere as well. You know, sometimes these small, simple things get so grand when they're in the hands of an author by Warren St. John. The book is Outcasts United. We'll have all of Bill Littlefield's picks at our website, herenow.org. He, of course, is host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game, and author himself. His most recent book is Only a Game, a collection of his essays. Bill, thanks as always, and Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you, Robin, and thanks very much.
Why do I think there'll be a book about Tiger Woods on your next list?
I think there'll probably be one on my desk by the time I get back to my office.
Thanks, Bill.